You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Kenyon's Run. Stage 7. Today we are in Mas de la Costa.
Well, hello from Spain. My name's Lionel Burney. I've been at the Vuelta a España today, and on the line is Richard Moore. Hello, Richard.
Hello, Lionel. Good evening.
Good evening. You're back home in Tooting.
Yeah.
I'm in a roadside hotel on the main road that runs parallel to the motorway up towards Tarragona and then Barcelona, sort of trying to break the back of tomorrow's big journey up into Catalonia. But my hotel promised an awful lot on the internet, but hasn't really delivered. You can technically see the sea, but I would need some binoculars to see it well. I'm really not on holiday.
Well, I am in London. I'm coming out to the Vuelta tomorrow, fly early in the morning. But I don't feel disconnected today, Lionel, because I had quite an amazing Vuelta experience in London today. I had a family day out in Richmond, mucking about on the Thames and having a pub lunch and all right, so then we got a boat down to Kew, and I got off there and jumped on the number 65 bus. And on the number 65 bus going back to Richmond was a former winner of the Vuelta a España.
Ah, well, I know who this will be.
A clue is that he was with Carlton Kirby.
So Sean Kelly.
On the top deck. One of them, you know, on those front seats at the top deck, both of them. And Sean Kelly was there, so we had a good chat. They were on their way back to, well, home and hotel from commentating on the stage. So that was quite strange, quite coincidence, but there you go, it was very enjoyable.
What was his take on the Vuelta so far?
Didn't really talk about the Vuelta.
Oh.
I had my 2.5-year-old with me, so he was sort of hogging the attention.
Oh, wow.
But Sean is getting out on his bike in the mornings and looking fit. I think we all agreed it was a tremendous stage and a tremendous finale today to the stage. And, well, I mean, the big question is, how many truffles do Movistar have now?
Well, that was my mangled attempt at an analogy that I was trying out on Daniel the other day when we had truffles for dinner. And, well, he rolled his eyes.
Don't try out analogies.
No, he rolled his eyes and it put me off. But what I was trying to say was that at that point in the race, Quintana had three truffles, Valverde had one, and the net effect of Valverde's move on that day when he went up the road with Roglic behind Lopez was to steal one of Quintana's truffles. So they had two truffles each. But meanwhile, Lopez and Roglic were kind of off snuffling about for fresh stores of truffles. And
I was going to ask, is there a finite amount of truffles in this Vuelta, or are there fresh ones to be had?
Well, I think every mountain stage offers fresh truffle opportunities, as we saw today. And stage 7 from Onda to Mas de la Costa, it's one of these goat track type finishes, very steep, dusty, concretey, rough, not all that pleasant to race on, I wouldn't have thought. The day started off without Davide Formolo of Bora Hansgrohe, one of the fallers yesterday, and a very rapid opening hour when they covered nearly 50 kilometres an hour in the peloton meant that TJ Van Garderen of EF Education First also pulled out. It took a long while for a very strong group to get clear, and into the last 60 kilometres of the race, a group of four came to the front from that lead group, and they were Philippe Gilbert of the Koenig Quickstep, Sergio Henao of UAE, Team Emirates, his cousin Sebastian Henao of Team Ineos, and finally Gianluca Brambilla of Trek Segafredo, who went across to them. They rode very well together until Gilbert attacked with about 12 kilometres to go, and only Sergio Henao could go with them. But on that final climb, there was no way they were going to stay clear. While all that was happening, the red jersey wearer Dylan Teuns of Bahrain Merida was dropped by the overall leaders, as was David de la Cruz, so they are out of the overall picture. Astana and Jumbo-Visma were to the fore, setting a hard pace into the bottom of the climb, and once the breakaway riders were all caught, it meant that the stage was just about four men. The riders who lace third to sixth overall this morning are now first to fourth. Nairo Quintana kicks things off. Primoz Roglic, Miguel Angel Lopez and Alejandro Valverde were the only ones who were able to go with him. Quintana tried at least twice to get away on his own. At one point, the four men were riding shoulder to shoulder across the full width of the road, or almost the full width of the road. A really striking image, that, showing that really not very much between them at all. In the final 200 metres, Valverde unleashed his sprint. He's so good on these kinds of finishes, isn't he? And the world champion won the stage, the 12th Vuelta stage of his career, and he won his first back in 2003 when Lopez was just 9 years old. I think the gap between Valverde and Lopez back in 2003 would have been a little bit bigger than it was today. Roglic was in the same time as Roglic was in the same time as Valverde, but there was 6 seconds worth of daylight between them and Lopez and Quintana. Lopez is back in red, Roglic is second at 6 seconds, Valverde's third, another 10 seconds back, and Quintana, who's taken the green points jersey from Sam Bennett, is fourth at 27 seconds. But the race surely is between these four now.
The fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Kenyon's Run.
Thank you very much to Rafa for sponsoring the cycling podcast. I was wearing my Rafa t-shirt today. Very nice it is too. And well, we now know the name of the winner of the first Pedaleur de Charme competition of this Vuelta, and they will receive a Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt. I must stress, my Rafa t-shirt was not a Pedaleur de Charme one. I know my limits, Richard. I was just wearing a classic Rafa t-shirt with the Rafa logo on the chest. But who's the winner?
And Rafa shorts, Lionel, I couldn't help but notice. You're very, very much on message with your clothing, with your attire. The winner is Madrazo, very close between him and Mitch Docker, but our stage winner from a couple of days ago. A lot of lobbying for Docker going on, but it was narrow in the end. 45% to Madrazo, 41% to Docker. So you said in last night's podcast I would be presenting, like, as if I was kind of swanning in to award Pedaleur de Charme t-shirts left, right and centre. I'm not just arriving for that that very important job, but I mean, you're more than welcome to present Madrazo with his Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt tomorrow morning if you happen to see him. Otherwise, I'm happy to do it as well on Sunday.
Tomorrow's a good day to do it, I would have thought, so I'll have a go. Yes,
have a go. Good luck explaining to him what it is and how he won it.
Well, I shall, yes. Well, I'll try my best. Talking of Mitch Docker, we'll hear a little bit from Mitch Docker in the third part of the podcast. And, of course, we've also got our now regular diarists, Nick Schultz and James Knox, coming up. Another couple of cracking instalments of their diaries, really growing into their role, recording different aspects of the race. But, Richard, you watch the stage.
Well, we should say, Lionel, maybe we should say at this point that James Knox, it was reported today that he had crashed and abandoned the race. Not true, as you'll hear, but he did have a nasty crash, which he plays down in his audio diary. It was only at 60 kilometres an hour or something, so he seemed to, well, you'll hear what he says, but he seems to suggest that meant he didn't hurt himself so much. They're a different breed, aren't they? But he did not abandon the race. In fact, he had not a bad day in the end. He's I know he's kind of not really made his mind up whether he's going for GC or not, but he's 25th overall, 10 minutes down, 10:44 down, and he had a wee go today, and both our diarists actually featured in a break at one point today, so yeah, he seems in quite good spirits, but you'll hear that when we hear his diary.
Should just say as well, apologies to listeners who were straight on the podcast as soon as it went live, because he, for about half an hour, last night's version had the previous night's diary entries in by mistake, just a little production problem which we got ironed out as soon as people let us know about it on social media. Thank you to everyone who did let us know. It gives us an idea of how many people are listening and eagerly awaiting James and Nick's diaries. But just a little word to
The messages were flooding.
They were.
In, yeah.
Just a little word for our producers, because they are a much underrated and essential part of our team, and they're working very quickly under quite a lot of time pressure, often not knowing exactly what's coming to them until it arrives in on their computers, basically. So mistakes do happen, and when they do, we try to rectify as quickly as possible. But sorry if you got the wrong version of the diaries. And if you haven't managed to hear yesterday's diaries, the episode is now correct, stage 6 episode now correct, so you can re-download it.
And if you did hear the incorrect one, I do recommend going back listening, because they were really good. And last night's producer's been fired now.
Oh, well, I mean, he's that's it. Yeah, ruthless.
No, only joking, John.
Absolutely not. No.
He's our first original. We'll never fire John.
Ever present since 2013, John Mooney. So, anyway, let's talk about today's stage, Richard, because we now know what we already suspected, which is that Lopez, Roglic, Valverde and Quintana are the four best climbers in the race. And the Vuelta is likely to be won by one of those four riders now, isn't it?
And the red jersey is like a bar of soap, isn't it? It's just kind of, Lopez is the one who's got a bit of a hold on it. I think it was a fantastic day for Primoz Roglic, and another really strong day for his team, Sepp Kuss. He came to the Vuelta last year on the back of the Tour of Utah, where he'd been really dominant and been very impressive, and there was a lot of expectation around him at the Vuelta last year, and I don't think he really got to show what he can do. He rode the Giro this year, and it was a young team supporting Roglic there, and again, they were missing Laurens De Ploes, who pulled out in the first week, and they were missing Robert Hesink, and, I don't think they were really there for Roglic when he needed them. Whereas here at the Vuelta, they've lost Kruijswijk, who's, the equivalent of losing Laurens De Ploes at the Giro, really. But Sepp Kuss seems to be stepping up, and I think I was listening to the podcast last night, and Daniel was talking about that difficult adjustment from racing in America to racing in Europe, and today was particularly difficult, fast technical sort of run into that climb and a narrow climb on these sort of concrete slabs, and Sepp Kuss was magnificent. I mean, he shredded that group, and what's impressive, I think, is that Roglic is living with the likes of Lopez and Quintana and Valverde on a climb like that, which is not really, you don't imagine that's the one that best suits his talents, but it's steep and punchy, and it's as Daniel would say, Roglic is the leader in the clubhouse at the moment with the time trial coming up next week. That gives him a minute at least a minute on these guys, minute and a half probably. So it's all at the moment looking extremely good for him, but a really exciting finish to the stage, and when you see the likes of Gilbert and Sergio Henao up the road in that break, they must have really fancied that again the break would have a good chance of staying away today, but the race was really on behind, and we criticised, I certainly criticised Movistar the other day for their tactics, and we were arguing about whether it were one truffle, two truffle, three truffle. Today they played an absolute blinder. They brought the break back, they did a lot of work to bring it back, and they had two men in that front group and they won the stage, so it couldn't really have gone better for them today.
Yeah, you mentioned how much work Astana in particular did on the run into the bottom of the climb, and Jumbo-Visma lent a bit of a hand as well, and I wondered whether that was because, remember when the race came here in 2016, when Matthias Frank won from a very big group that got away and got a lot of time and contested the stage, Leopold Koenig was second. And the big battle, though, was between Contador, Froome, Quintana and Chavez on that occasion. And they were sort of three and a half minutes down on the remains of the break that was still up the road, and were kind of coming through and past people and weren't really racing on clear road. And I wondered whether that was one of the priorities, because that road, you want to be able to have the best possible chance on the steeper sections of picking your line clearly and getting through as clearly as possible. And the four of them, when they were all side by side, it did look like that they were just sizing each other up. And I suppose you look at the result today, and Roglic would have to be the happiest of the four of them, because that's the territory where you would imagine that Lopez would have the upper hand and the advantage, or maybe Quintana as a former winner on that climb, admittedly not in the Vuelta, and also a former Vuelta champion, of course, and a Giro champion, so one of the most experienced in terms of Grand Tour winners. And so you're absolutely right.
And actually, it was you know, Roglic. There was a little bit of daylight between Roglic and the two Colombians, which was a bit of a surprise to see Roglic able to follow Valverde. And I thought at one point he was going to challenge him for the win on, as you say, a finish really made for Valverde. That's a sign of how good Roglic is. And you know, we heard Addy the Engels in last night's podcast, and I think that. This is a different proposition to the Giro, really. And Roglic has had a long time out of racing. He's just been training and preparing for this race, and he's in a really, really strong position.
Yeah, there. I think if he has a good day on Andorra at the weekend, and then does a good time trial, he may well be in such a commanding position that it would require a real, a real implosion in the final week, which, I mean, could happen, of course.
Lionel. I mean, what's happened to you? I mean, Daniel's been reprimanding you for this as well, but you seem to be determined to call this race as early as possible.
Well, yeah, but I'm changing my mind every day, though. 2 days ago, I thought Lopez was going to win.
He had it wrapped up
early, but he wasn't. Over. He wasn't as impressive today as I was expecting. I was expecting that move. Maybe he's more suited to the longer climb in Andorra on Sunday, and we'll see something there. But a sort of B minus for Lopez so far, considering, you know, he could get up the road and drag people with him rather than be on the back foot a bit. Anyway, Astana, though, are very, very strong, of course. They have Izaguirre, they have Fuglsang, of course. They look really well equipped.
They've got two Izaguirres.
Two Izaguirres, of course, yeah. Jon was up there today, not sure what happened to Gorka. And Fuglsang was a couple of minutes, 2.5 minutes down. Obviously, here working for Lopez, and I grabbed a very quick word with Fuglsang at the Astana bus, where he kind of made that point about the jersey being like a bar of soap, or it's on some kind of what would it be on? It's bouncing around anyway.
A bit of elastic.
It's on a bit of elastic, Richard. That's it. We're a week into the Vuelta. Are you happy with where Miguel Angel Lopez is at the moment? Obviously, he's in the red jersey, but it's only a few seconds.
I think it's quite good. It's almost too good, but because we spent quite some energy trying to control also the other day, and we have it one day, we give it away, we get it back, we give it away, we get it back. But yeah, I think we cannot complain at all, and at least he showed now a few times that he's among the best here. So, yeah, it's good.
You've got a very strong team. What is your role in the team?
Well, trying to help the team. That is what I'm here for. And then personally, I would like to try to win a stage. But the main goal is trying to win the Vuelta. And then we see.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, interrupting the Vuelta a España. He's actually at the Deutschland Tour at the moment, but he's managed to interrupt our Vuelta coverage to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Roca Sunglasses, a company founded, like we were, in 2013. They were founded in a garage in Austin, Texas, with the mission to create the world's finest eyewear. And 6 years and 30 plus patents later, Roca athletes have won numerous world titles and stages of the Tour de France. And, well, we heard from Dan Martin in last night's episode. Dan Martin's not actually racing here, but Miguel Angel Lopez is wearing Roca sunglasses, and he's back in the red jersey tonight. And, Richard, I've been wearing Roca sunglasses while I've been out here. I've got the Barton model of sunglasses, which is part of the Leisure range, a real classic summer sunglass design with a matte black frame and a really nice dark lens, which when you wear the glasses in bright sunshine doesn't actually make the exterior feel kind of dingy. It still feels bright, but it takes that edge off the brightness and makes it makes everything just feel that little bit softer and nicer. But the thing about the glasses is I've been running every other morning here in Spain, and as you can imagine, it's pretty warm. Even at sort of 8 o'clock in the morning, it can be in the mid-20s. And normally when you run in leisure sunglasses, they kind of slip about or bounce about. But because of the patented Gecko technology on the temples and the nose piece, they just do not move. And I was slightly sceptical about this idea that the sunglasses wouldn't bounce around on my face, but they really don't. And, well, as we know...
Do you break sweat when you're running, Lionel?
Yeah, well, I certainly do. I don't go very fast, but I do break sweat. But the contact points are ridged, but very sort of gently ridged rubber, and they mimic the sticky feet of a gecko. And I would say they stick without feeling sticky, which is the other thing. You don't want them to kind of feel like they're, you know, clammy, stuck on your face. They just fit nicely. And I've been wearing them, you know, just around the buses at the starts and the finishes, but they've really come into their own when I've been running. So if you would like to check out the Roca range of sunglasses, go to roca.com/Vuelta. to get 20% off your order. That's roca.com/Vuelta, and Roca is spelt R-O-K-A. Roca say they are the lightest and most advanced eyewear in the peloton, and well, if you check them out, you'll be able to judge that for yourself.
I do love how in our newsletter, Lionel, it says Roca sunglasses as worn by Miguel Angel Lopez and Lionel Burney. Someone being a little
I
bit
mischievous
there. I
don't know whether that works in Roca's favour, to be honest. I mean, Miguel Angel Lopez, fine. But my...
Roca haven't requested for that to be changed yet.
My endorsement is purely on using them, wearing the glasses. So, well, there we are. It's time to hear from James Knox and Nick Schultz then. First up, James Knox, and then Nick Schultz.
Well, well, well. Plenty to talk about today. Some of it good, most of it bad. One of those days. Didn't really pick the best day to have a big get down, but I'm okay. Hacked away to the finish. Still alive and kicking, so in the end, not too bad. And came away pretty lucky, to be honest. Nothing too major. It was a big fight again for the breakaway. And thought for one point I was in a nice move of, I think it was like 15 guys. Steve Barr was in there with me and a fellow audio diarist, Nick Schultz. We had a little nod, a little bit of a let's have it sort of moment. But in the end, it wasn't to be. I think we got brought back by a lot of Visma, who weren't too keen on letting a big move go. And then after that, Armand Gilbert, roomy for this. So got up the road, nice move. I think it was like 10 guys in the end after a couple more went across. And then it looked to be quite a standard day out. But then all of a sudden, Movistar took it on. Two-thirds of the way through, I think, roughly. And oh boy, did they take it on. It was really, really hard, really, really fast, all lined out. I had a bit of a horrible moment with maybe 50 or 60k to go. Everyone in one line, right hand side of the road, straight road. And there was this sort of bush sticking out into the road, and everyone was making these last moments, like flick out, get round it. And unfortunately, the whole tailback effect, by the time it came to me, I didn't really see it come in. Handlebar got caught in this bush and just pulled me sideways and ended up going down quite fast. To be honest, sounds strange, but I think it must have been like 50-60k an hour, but it was so fast that sort of helped me out, because I just basically got launched off the bike and had a good old roll on the tarmac. So got a few burns, a bit of a bruised elbow, but nothing more than that. Made for a bit of a horrible chase back on though. I was flapping in and around cars, begging the medical car just to have a look at me so I could have a bit of a breather, begging for an extra paracetamol, but in the end only got one. they put some plasters on me and took care of me, all at 60k an hour, which is always a good laugh. And yeah, after that I was sort of in survival mode. Second to last climb of the day was really hard again, and I was sort of out of position, just made it back to the bunch in time for that. And yeah, then just sort of coming round, drop riders, hanging on the back, which didn't make it, not really making my life easier, because all these little accelerations to close gaps and kicking out of corners on these twisty roads over the top of the Pinnacle climb was really, really difficult, and guys were sort of exploding left, right and centre. And after closing a couple of gaps myself, I did actually explode on a little random little kicker before the final descent to the climb, and just had to sort of make my way down the descent and hack away up the final climb, which, yeah, that final climb, what was that all about? I'd checked on Strava and seen that, I think hard knot is 2k and 12%, and this was 3.9 and 12.5% average. So when I saw that, I knew I was in trouble. I knew it was not going to be a nice day. And I had to go on the spare bike, which I don't think I had the 36 on either. So double whammy right there. Groveling away, crawling up this climb, trying to stare down spectators for a nice little push just to keep me going, because at points there I was at a standstill. In the convoy as well, which really isn't nice, trying to get in around cars and you feel the heat off the exhaust. It's hot enough as it is, you don't need that. Yeah. Oh, and there's this bizarre thing, I've been the victim of wrongly broadcasted updates as well. Yesterday they said I crashed and I didn't crash, and then today they said I abandoned and I didn't abandon. So my poor mum and dad have been having a real stressful time coming to watch me. They're not having much luck. They came to see me at the Giro last and now they're here. So yeah, they're not really lucky omens just for the moment, but I feel for them having to put up with the stress. I can't really imagine what it's like. Obviously for me, I just have to get on with it, but for them, they don't know what's going on. They just see bits of update on Twitter and the TV, and they got my brother at home sending a message to say I'm out of the race, and they're on the final climb and then came rushing back to the last town where they knew the team bus was to see if I was okay and if I was there and all this. So yeah, I saw them when I came back to the bus and they were a bit, they were a bit shaken up, so it's not nice, but I guess it's part of the sport, and yeah, lucky not to be any worse off, but just have to get on with it now. It's part of cycling. Crashes happen, and yeah, plenty of people are in worse ways than I am, so all good. Crack on.
All right, stage 7 done and dusted. Brutal finish today. Already forgotten the name of the climb, but it was incredibly steep. Quick summary of the day. It took a long time for the breakaway to go. It was a flat start and a lot of roundabouts, a lot of towns. It was pretty messy. It took, I think, about 50 or 60k for the right move to go. So that moved things along pretty quickly. From there, it was pretty straightforward. The pace just progressively got quicker, and Movistar showed that they had intention for the stage win, and they finished it off pretty nicely. Just going through some of the questions that have come through over the last couple of days. There was one about navigating through the peloton with biddens. So when we go back to the car, we get a bunch of biddens to bring back up to our teammates and our leaders. So obviously we've got to get from the back of the bunch. Normally for me, back to the front, to where the rest of the team is sitting. There's a kind of a universal word in the peloton used, which is service. So if you're on the side of the group and you just sort of yell out service, normally people will give you a bit of leeway and let you through once they see that you've got a jersey full of bottles. there is the odd sneaky rider that will be able to service without without actually having anything with them, but that's generally frowned upon. There was another question here about Velo games. Noxie's definitely a man to ask about that. I know he's right into it, but I personally don't play on the Velo games. And just scrolling through some more here. There's one about being approached by journalists. For me, it's almost never. I don't mind that. I'm not a big name in cycling, so I don't need to worry about journalists, and it's not too bad just being able to keep to yourself pre and post stage. And there's one here also about the differences between Kaharal and Mitchelton. First and foremost is obviously the just the sheer size in team. Mitchelton's obviously a bigger budget, a bigger powerhouse in the sport than Kaharal is. So there's just generally a bit more pressure. But that's not sort of drilled into us. That's just something you can feel. You know, when you're in the group and you've got guys like Esteban Chavez or the Yates brothers in the team at the race, you can feel that there's a bit of pressure around the team that's brought upon ourselves, because obviously we want to succeed, and with riders like that, there's a general feeling that we can succeed. The cultures in both teams really, really good, very relaxed, and just super friendly amongst all the riders, and there's I haven't witnessed any conflict really in either of the teams. And that question went on to ask if I feel bicultural. Yes and no. I'm certainly Australian at heart, but I spent a lot of time overseas, a few years in France and a few years in Spain. It's certainly nice being able to speak those languages, but I think the Australian culture will sort of always be in there with me. For now, that's it. I'm enjoying reading your questions, guys, so if there's any more, keep them coming through, and always happy to respond to them. Thanks.
Well, that was the latest installment from James Knox and Nick Schultz. And I mentioned earlier, fascinating here that they were both in the same move at some point in the race today. And they sort of acknowledged that. I love that. I mean, you know, there's this kind of invisible bond between them, isn't there? Because they're both diarists on the race. And I think they know each other quite well because both live in Girona. We didn't know that when we asked them to keep diaries, which is interesting. A lot of riders live in Girona, obviously, but Nick Schultz has always seemed sort of like an outsider, I suppose, having ridden for Kaharal and come into the World Tour by a slightly unconventional path. But they do know each other, and I think they're planning to, if they're in the same hotel at any point during the Vuelta, to actually sort of have a chat and record a chat between them for their a slightly different version of their audio diary. But they're doing a great job, and it's a really interesting insight into the race. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, to hear James Knox talk about his crash in such a light way, and a flippant way almost.
I always wonder, yeah.
It's amazing, really, because he must have
hurt
himself.
I always wonder, is it part of the psyche to kind of play down the significance of those kind of crashes and sort of minimise what actually happened, just for the sake of kind of self-preservation almost, not wishing to dwell on... You know, I mean, I'm just trying to think about how I would feel if that was me, and I'd be sitting kind of quivering about it now, hours later, as I think most people would. But these guys, yeah,
feeling sorry
I think
for yourself,
so.
Yeah. I think, yeah. And if I was, if podcasts had existed when I was a cyclist and I'd been keeping an audio diary for one, I think after a day like today, I'd have gone, nah, not tonight. I'll give it a miss. You know, not in the mood. Not in the mood. It would put me in a bad mood crashing like that.
Well,
yeah. James didn't really sound in a... He sounded
well,
pretty...
Yeah, I mean, we obviously we really appreciate the insights they're giving, because I think the other thing is that they just... It reinforces the idea that I think we're not flippant about, that we've got some kind of one definitive version of the race from what we've seen on TV, that, you know, everybody's race story is different, and they see it through their own eyes, from their own very sort of singular perspective, and the race itself is made up of, you know, 172 or whatever it is accounts of that nature.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast, always appreciated. And you can still get 25% off all your Science and Sport sports nutrition products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25.
And Science and Sport have recently launched their Plant 20 range, which is an all-natural vegan approach to on-the-go protein whilst also being low sugar, packed with protein, which is a key nutrient in the growth and maintenance of lean muscle mass. And well, the most important thing about it is that it is 100% vegan certified, packed with protein and plant-based. So if you would like to check out that particular range, then go to scienceinsport.com, and if you want to order some, you can get 25% off.
And if you're interested in veganism, and quite a lot of people are these days, then you did a Kilometre Zero on veganism with Adam Hansen at the Giro, didn't you, Lionel?
Yes, I did, yeah. He has an entirely vegan diet, which is not really the kind of conventional thinking, is it, in sports nutrition. The idea is that you need meat protein, or the common thought is that you need meat protein and to perform at your best. Adam Hansen doesn't agree with that, and he observes an all-vegan diet. And Thomas de Gendt, his teammate on Lotto Soudal, he shuns another kind of cycling tradition.
I thought you were going to say he was a carnivore. Massage. I thought you were going to say he only eats meat.
No, he never has a post-race massage. And today's Kilometre Zero focuses on the job of the soigneurs, and that's available to listen to this, well, now, along with our other Kilometre Zeros, supported by Hansgrohe at Showers and Taps.
Enjoyed that, Lionel. Now, enjoyed your soigneurs at Kilometre Zero, especially your kind of reportage from the feeding zone. We've never done that before.
Yeah.
Never done that before.
I've never done
years.
That before. Yeah. No. I know. I was quite surprised that I'd not done that. I'd been out to see the eco-waste collection zone at the Tour de France, which comes maybe a few kilometres after the feed zone, but never actually been out to the feed zone for the Cycling Podcast. Just recapping a few things that happened overnight and this morning on the race. There was a terrible crash yesterday which claimed Nicholas Roach and put the former red jersey wearer out of the race, as well as two riders from EF Education First, Rigoberto Urán and Hugh Carthy, who were both in hospital last night. And Urán is still in hospital recovering from a punctured lung. Really quite serious injuries there. And TJ Van Garderen, of course, tried to continue but pulled out this morning, or well, it wasn't this morning, the stage started around lunchtime, but he pulled out early in the stage. And at the finish, I caught up with Mitch Docker, kind of expecting the mood to be a little bit bleaker than it was, but Mitch Docker put a reasonably positive spin on things.
Look, actually, the morale's pretty good. You know, like, obviously the obvious, losing Rigo, and especially Hugh as well, who's going really good. And then, the final blow was we had TJ up there who was moving up in GC and a chance for the stage, and then he went down. Actually, he's pulled out today too. So it's a real shame. But the thing was, we just sort of switched straight over to, you know, Danny Martinez and Sergio Higuita. Straight away, we're like, okay, plan B, let's go. Let's move forward and put those guys in the position, keep them on GC, because both those guys are moving really well too. And it was really disappointing, but on the flip side, it was like plan B, and they're great guys and they're really motivated too. So the morale dropped, but then straight away it was, we worked through it and we got back on it.
And they're both young guys, aren't they? And learning quickly, I guess.
They are, yeah, and they've shown, you know, heaps of talent, obviously, in the past. So it's just if they can now step up on this stage here at the Vuelta, which I feel they can. And now it's a great opportunity. I was just saying to my teammate, sometimes it's actually easier working with five guys in a weird way. Everyone knows that there's no one else to do your job. So when you get your job, it's like, well, it's me. This is my job. No one else is going to come in if I'm on a bad day. And everyone just sort of steps up. So you move around together with five guys pretty easy in the bunch. And I think we'll bond really quickly, and it's going to be tough, but you know, we're not expected to ride the front or do something like that, so we just slip into a different role.
Well, I'm not sure why I was surprised that Mitch Docker would be positive. He seems to be someone who looks on the bright side, and
well, he hasn't heard yet that he just lost out in the Pedal de Charme competition, so let's see how he responds to that.
But well, maybe you'll say I've got loads of t-shirts, I'm all right.
Yeah, he probably will,
but they have two young Colombian riders in the team, Sergio Higuita and Daniel Martinez, who finished respectively 3:40 and 6:30 down today.
And Higuita crashed today. Didn't he?
That's right.
But he seemed all right.
And I think you know, this kind of the next 2 weeks basically of this race are going to be an opportunity to see just what they can do, because EF Education First really have no option but to recalibrate and try to go for something else, which may well be an attempt to get a stage win now, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a shame because they came in, I think, with really high hopes and did a good team time trial, and a really strong team, you know, with Van Garderen in support of Rigoberto Urán. And I thought it might be a race where we would see Education First kind of challenge Astana, Jumbo Visma as one of the stronger teams in the race. So they've gone from, you know, having, you know, anything being possible to very little now being possible, and it's a big recalibration for them, I would imagine.
Well, Richard, you'll be here tomorrow. Well, you won't be here. Don't come here, whatever you do. But you'll be in Barcelona, where I will hand over the podcasting baton, or the podcasting microphone.
And the car.
And you'll see us through. And the car, yeah. And I'll clear the car out a bit. And you'll see the race through the middle week. And then I'll rejoin you for the final few stages. And let's see what next week has to offer. I mean, in at the deep end, because Sunday stage is very short, only 97 kilometers, but it goes to Andorra. It's one for the climbers. It could be short, sweet and explosive, couldn't it?
Yeah, I know, that really is being thrown in, isn't it, at the deep end. But I'm looking forward to it. We'll catch up tomorrow night, Lionel. I think we'll record the podcast tomorrow night, won't we? When we meet up, I'll have watched the stage, you'll have been at the stage, and we'll meet up and do the podcast. That's the plan anyway. Just one other little thing that escaped my mind from today's stage. Theo Gegenhart on the attack. And he apparently has had stomach problems the last few days. But he said he felt a lot better today and he was on the attack. So that was good to see. And hopefully we'll see more of him over the next few stages or so. But yeah, the race is nicely kind of poised, I think. There's still a lot to play for and a lot of intrigue about, what's going to happen. That time trial coming up on Tuesday is very important, of course. It's kind of strange, isn't it? We had a time trial in Pau at the Tour de France, and we've got a time trial finishing in Pau at the Vuelta. That's going to be quite odd, I think.
That is slightly odd, isn't it?
Discombobulating.
I wonder if that's ever happened before.
It's very strange. But anyway, it'll be strange to be in Pau at the Vuelta, because it's a place we go to every year with the Tour de France, and it's so synonymous with the Tour de France that to be there with the Vuelta is going to be a little bit odd. But anyway, I'm looking forward to going there, because it's a nice place.
Are you staying in that hotel, Richard, that we stayed in at the Tour?
I'm not. I decided, because we've got two nights there, so I decided to stay in the centre of Pau, and of course at the Vuelta, hotels are far easier to come by than at the Tour. So I chose a city centre hotel, nothing fancy, Lionel, which does a comment caught my eye today on our Facebook discussion group from Jim Cotton, couldn't help but consider where the proceeds of my Friends of the Podcast subscription money over the past years is being diverted as I listened to Daniel and Lionel dissect the joys of their truffle meal last night on the latest podcast. I didn't have the same thought myself, actually. I mean, I listened with that curiosity and a little bit of envy as well as you tucked into your shaved truffle.
It was very modest. It was very, well,
it always
very modest
is. I mean, you don't have a huge amount of truffle. You don't need a huge amount of truffle, do you?
No.
Even you, Lionel.
I bit into a whole truffle as if it were an apple. But
oh,
I think that's
goodness
fine,
me!
Isn't it?
Oh. No. Oh dear. People get the wrong idea. It's not like that at all. I'm sure it was very reasonable. I mean, Spain is exceptional value, isn't it? Are you finding that on this trip as well?
Yes, I am. I mean, maybe not so in the sort of touristy areas, although it's sort of value in a different way. I mean, some of the stuff on offer has not been that great, but it's never been terribly expensive. But the truffle meal was a highlight so far, that's for sure.
Well, I've been reading Laurie Lee's memoir about travelling to Spain in the 1930s and travelling down through some of the same places that we're going in the Vuelta, actually. I might try and bring in some references from that book into the Vuelta coverage, but maybe not. Maybe I will, maybe I won't. But it's been very interesting. But we're from France. I'll be going to sort of the Basque country and down the centre of Spain. And it's a strange final week, so I'm looking forward to that because, you know, Valverde's there. He's still very much a contender. He won today, of course. And we do expect, as I think Daniel said last night, Valverde to fade a bit in the final week. But that often coincides with the high mountains that he really often doesn't perform that well in. Whereas the final week of the Vuelta this year is quite racers stages rather than the kind of 2,000 meter plus climbs that we've seen.
You're getting so far ahead
yeah,
of
okay.
yourself here.
Right, let's
you've not even arrived.
Know, let's,
you've not even arrived
let's
in Spain yet.
Let's discuss this tomorrow night again, Lionel.
Well, before we go, let's say a big thank you. Let's say a big thank you to some of the people who are funding my truffle habit. No, I'm joking. Who are enabling us to cover the Grand Tours and also provide the subscriber-only episode for Friends of the Podcast. A big thank you to Jonathan Pinhorn, Richard Sanderson, Mickey Vukovic, Ian McGillivray, Niall Kidd and Martin Price.
And thank you to Lee Saunders, James Southern, Pierre Bernard Tifo, William Lockwood, Richard Pelling, Ian Goldsworthy. I'm going to add a few more as well because some people chip in a little bit more and pay to be extra special friends. And we're going to want to say thanks to them as well. Kevin Sweeney, Alan Thompson, Benjamin Lowe, Christopher Leach, Craig Ward, David Gilbert. I'll do a few more of these on the next few nights. But thank you very much indeed for your support of the Cycling Podcast. And there's a lot of special episodes available to listen to if you are a friend of the podcast, and there are more to come, including our Tour de France road trip at some point.
Oh, goodness, yeah. Well, that will probably come out to coincide with the unveiling of the 2020 tour route in October, I would have thought. But, we've got all that to decide after the Vuelta, haven't we? In the meantime, Richard, I'll see you in Barcelona tomorrow evening.
See you there.